Like the show? Want to listen to episodes early? Consider becoming a patron. Starting at the $3 a month level, patrons get access to a custom patron-only feed where we put out episodes of upstairs studio podcasts like the Childcare Bar and Grill, Miss Becky's Classroom, That Early Childhood Nerd, the Renegade Rules podcast, and others early. That feed is just for patrons. You could be one of them. Go to patreon.com/playvolutionhq or click the link in the show description to learn more. Childcare Bar and Grill podcast. Jeff Johnson coming to you live from the new downstairs upstairs studio because that's where we are. There's a fireplace here, so I mean, who wouldn't want the studio downstairs? Lisa Murphy, Tasha Johnson, and Josie is with us live in studio.
Lucky you.
Andrew Rozak is on the phone with us from the Institute for Childhood Preparedness. We talked to him in a previous episode about preparedness overall and in general. This time we're talking about active shooter drills because, you know, back in my direct caregiver days, and it hasn't been, I mean, it was 2013 when we closed down our program, the family child care program, this really wasn't a thing that was going on here in Iowa when it came to training and requirements. And now it seems to be happening all over the place. And I mean, maybe not as much as it should. And so Andrew, walk us through active shooter training and what that looks like and what it shouldn't look like, because I think there's a lot going on here. So where do we start?
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me back. It's great to be back on the podcast with everybody. So, you know, here's a topic that, gosh, I think we can all agree we didn't wish we even had to think about. But, you know, sadly, we're seeing these incidents happen more and more frequently. And parents are starting to ask questions and staff are starting to ask questions as well. So let me just start by saying we've been very, very lucky in the early childhood sector that we, you know, have not had a mass shooting at one of our early childhood programs. And gosh, if you think about it, it's in many ways a real miracle that nothing bad has happened. I'm sure everybody listening has probably got a story about a custody battle, a divorce, a new boyfriend, a new girlfriend, you know, something like that that's went awry, or even, you know, just getting the staff turnover. You know, annually in early childhood, we have a 40% annual turnover.
Yeah.
It's one of the mm-hmm. highest ones of any sector. And, you know, that means people are constantly coming and going. And sometimes we've seen this worker on worker violence in other incidents. So, yeah, we've been very lucky. Nothing's happened. But I don't think that we should get lulled into a false sense of security. We've seen a lot of incidents throughout the United States that have come close. And just very luckily, nothing bad has happened at the last minute. Folks have intervened. So it's a topic that we're certainly taking seriously. I've been working on active shooter for early childhood for, oh gosh, over 4 years now. I've got the first and only active shooter curriculum and training for early childhood in the country. We've given that in 17 states, including 9 tribal Indian nations, and trained about 15,000 childcare providers and early education professionals on our curriculum. Really happy to announce we've got a book coming out in early 2020, active shooter for the early childhood sector. That'll be coming out through a collaboration with Griffinhout and Kaplan. So look for that coming out soon. But cool. In the meantime, let's talk about some of this stuff.
So, I mean, I've seen video of and articles on active shooter drills that are going on. And a lot of these are in elementary and high schools, I guess, where I don't know, it's the SWAT team comes in and there's blanks firing and this kind of stuff. I really don't know if these are fake videos people are putting out or the real thing. And I see a lot of terrified children, and you know, I remember the very end of Duck and Cover when they wanted me to hide under Russian nukes, hide under my desk. And that was terrifying to some extent. And so those kind of drills, what are your thoughts on those? I mean, first off, I'd like to have a grown-up tell me what I should be thinking about this. Because I don't know, is that the way we should be doing it? Or what's the deal?
Well, I mean, first off, I just penned an op-ed a couple of weeks ago in one of the big Pennsylvania papers and the West Virginia papers about this. There is certainly a time and place for those kind of exercises and those kind of drills when you're dealing with adults. Now, uh-huh. I was involved in the preparation for the Super Bowl. I did some of these drills. I took over an old abandoned hospital and I put about 200, you know, nurses and doctors and ER staff and paramedics through a drill. We did it with the SWAT team. Yes, we did do blanks and all that kind of stuff. And I think that level of training was appropriate for the audience. Now, however, I don't think that the folks that are they're doing these kind of drills, and I'm talking specifically about simulating gunfire, shooting people with pellets, running around screaming, this kind of stuff that are doing this with our young kids, I don't think that they're doing this appropriately. I don't think it's appropriate to put kids in that situation. I think we can still accomplish the goals and objectives we're seeking to accomplish without traumatizing folks. And my goal is to make sure that people are prepared and not scared. And that also includes making sure that they're trained and not traumatized.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I mean, the adults, I mean, it's probably terrifying for a lot of adults. I don't think there's a lot of preschool teachers who went into the profession thinking that was something they were going to ever have to deal with. But so it might be mildly traumatized or maybe fully traumatizing to them, I guess. But putting kids through that just seems like overkill to a great extent. I'm going to look up that op-ed you wrote and make sure I share that on social media too. That sounds great. So how should we be preparing early learning people for active shooters so that they truly are prepared and not scared?
Well, first, and this is the reason that I wrote our own training, our own curriculum, because, you know, we have to recognize that we are unique. There's training out there for, you know, high schools and colleges and you know, businesses and office places and stuff like that. We're not any of those things. If you've seen one early learning program, you've seen one early learning program. They're all so different, right?
Yeah.
So we have to recognize that we're very unique. Not only are we unique in our operations, but we're also very, very unique in our clientele. And that has to be forefront. And as a lawyer, I tell you, I'm looking at this stuff all the time. There's been a myriad of lawsuits filed against people who have done active shooter drills incorrectly. And basically the lawsuit goes, look, you knew that this was a scary topic. You knew if you did this wrong, I would probably get scared and suffer some kind of trauma. And maybe that trauma would exist for years with PTSD. And you were negligent or you were grossly negligent. And essentially you did this drill in a way that harmed me. And now I'm going to sue you for $12 million. And by the way, your insurance company's probably not going to stand there with you because they're going to say, whoa, 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 what you did what? You're not covered for this. And you're going to be fighting this for the next 4 or 5 years alone by yourself at a cost of, you know, who knows how much money, right?
So that doesn't sound fun.
No, it doesn't sound fun. So I'm a big proponent of doing emergency drills. And like I said in a prior episode, you know, I'm the jerk that makes you do the fire drill during nap time because I want to see how it goes and if they got shoes on and shoes off and evacuation cribs and all this. However, and I don't take this lightly, you know, I'm a strong believer that we should not be doing any kind of unannounced active shooter drills. There's simply too many things that can go wrong if you're doing an unannounced active shooter drill. You know, first off, it's already a scary situation, so that's going to unnecessarily add stress. Second off, you can only imagine if the FedEx guy, if a person walking their dog, like if the mailman happens to stumble into your exercise and they think it's the real deal. And now suddenly they're calling the police, or maybe they've got a concealed carry permit and now they're coming into your facility trying to be the hero or the good guy.
Yeah,
these things can go south in a myriad of different ways. So I don't think that we need to be doing any kind of unannounced drills.
Uh-huh.
And I also am a firm believer that we need to get all the adults on the same page and get them trained and get them with a formulated plan before we ever think about, you know, bringing our children into these kind of situations, these kind of drills.
When you say adults, do you include the parents and the staff all together then too?
Well, so this might be a little controversial, but
welcome to the show.
Looking at the threats that we have, the biggest threat I feel that's facing early childhood is going to be a disgruntled parent.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think it's going to, if this, God forbid this situation ever plays out, but if it does play out, I'm really worried it's going to be a custody dispute and a parent with non-custodial parent comes in and tries to get their kid, and somebody at the early childhood program is going to have to tell that person no.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't hear no very much in society anymore, right? So I'm really worried that the parent may be the person that we're ultimately trying to protect the children and staff from. So while I think it's a great idea to let the parents know that, hey, we're doing all we can possibly do to protect the kids
from
this
you,
is a priority for us, all that kind of stuff, I don't think it's in our best interest to be sharing the detailed nuances of our plans with parents.
Very smart.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a sad world to live in, but that's the world we live in.
Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of where I stand on that. So I would say, you know, and we do this, honestly, we do it at least once a week throughout the country. We go to a program, we get a, you know, either a half a day or a teacher's institute day or something like that. We sit down, we do a couple hours of classroom lecture discussion, review some prior cases that have happened, what's worked well, what hasn't worked so well. And then I like to put teachers in their actual environment and put them in their classrooms and then work with them to identify and test out response options so that they can feel more comfortable, they can feel empowered, they know what to do, what works and what doesn't work in their actual individual classrooms. And I feel that's really where the rubber meets the road on this kind of stuff.
And so, I mean, it really boils down in a lot of ways to helping the caregivers be more situationally aware.
I think that's a huge part. I mean, it's amazing how many folks live their life and, you know, they've got their headphones in or they're, you know, I don't know, they're on Instagram or whatever they're doing on those phones, but they have absolutely no idea of what's going on around them. And that is really not a good way to live your life, especially with all the stuff we see going on. So I'll give you, you know, the great thing about doing this work, you know, Lisa and Jeff, is that I've got so many friends now throughout the country, and pretty much every week I get a call or an email or a text from somebody saying, hey, this thing happened. What do you think about this? Or, hey, we're thinking of that. You know, can you help us out with this? So my good friend Steve in Indianapolis, he sent me a video last week of a situation in his parking lot. And basically what happened is there was they've had some trouble. They've had a little bit of a few break-ins. I wouldn't even call them break-ins. They've been robberies. What happens is parents are getting out of their car to drop their kids off. Well, it's just a couple of seconds. They're not locking their cars, and the thieves are sitting there taking advantage of that, right? Well, this particular incident that happened last week was that one of the parents was getting ready to get out of their vehicle and bring their child in for drop-off, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, you see this random, like, you know, cargo van pull up in the parking lot. And, you know, now if you think about it, a cargo van is probably not going to be equipped with a child seat, like a car seat, right? Because usually they don't have, you know, back seats.
Yeah, most of
and
them.
And, the way this guy parked is really awkward. He kind of came in and took up two or three spaces. So just the whole thing looked really odd. And kudos to the mother. You know, they've been doing some great training, and we've been out on site with them a few times. But she recognized, like, hey, this is a car I don't recognize. It's kind of weird. The windows are tinted. I can't really see in. And this is a cargo van, which is kind of out of place in this setting at, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. So she stayed in the vehicle. She didn't get out. And basically, you know, after a few minutes, she didn't get out. Another car pulled over, and they didn't get out. And finally, that van drove away. So that was really good situational awareness on their part, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, we just don't pay attention to what's around us. And I think, you know, we talk about this all the time on the show about, you know, you as a caregiver, you need to know what's going on in your classrooms. Well, you need to know what's going on the other side of the fence when you're out on the playground and those kind of things. You don't need to be freaking out about it, but just being, you know, having your head on a swivel now and then looking up from the phone is probably good practice.
Well, and really the thing I've been trying to push, you know, again, we're kind of invisible in some communities, we're forgotten about, and it's amazing to me how many communities are not including early childhood in their emergency alert system. pretty much every school has figured this out, and they get a text or an email or a phone call from the local police. If a bank robbery occurs in their vicinity, or if an escaped convict is out there on the loose, or whatever happens. But we don't usually get those as first notifications. What we usually get in early childhood is we have maybe a parent that's dropped off a younger kid in our program, but they have an older kid who's actually in the school system. And the parents get notified of the lockdown or whatever from the school, and then they call us at the child care center. Uh-huh. Well, we got to fix that. And a couple communities are working on it, but we need to see that more nationally, where we are getting those alerts firsthand. Because, you know, hey, we could be out on the playground and anything else. And it's a lot harder with the age group that we're serving versus, you know, middle school and high school students, at least I would argue.
Yeah, yeah. Just that heads up is a valuable thing.
And the other thing, I guess, to that, Jeff, is that situational awareness. So you have the luxury of knowing what's common in your area, right? You know what sights, what sounds, what smells, what people are familiar. So if you start hearing things or seeing things that are out of the ordinary, if I'm out on the playground and I'm hearing sirens and helicopters and more sirens, that's probably pretty unusual. And I don't want you to be the person out on the playground saying, I'm hearing a lot of sirens. I wonder what's going on today. I want you to be the person saying, I'm hearing a lot of sirens. That's unusual. There must be something going on in the area. You know what? Let's get the kids off the playground and go inside until we can find out what the heck is going on. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about here.
Yeah, yeah. So would it come I've got so many questions.
I do too.
Okay, go ahead, Lisa Murphy.
Well, I have an overarching one that might be its own podcast, and I don't know what kind of time you have today, Mr. Andrew. But can you speak for a quick minute about how to maintain a balanced approach as opposed to an overreactive, fear-based approach to preparedness, especially with the active shooting?
Yeah, and this is not, you know, sadly, it's not unique to us. We've been doing a lot of work with churches and synagogues and mosques, and they're struggling with this as well. You know, nobody wants to go to a jail, and that's not the kind of nurturing, caring environment that we want to have in early childhood. And the same thing with, you know, the religious organizations. They want to be welcoming. They want to do their work. They don't want you feeling like you're going into jail to go and you know, worship God or whatever. So I think, you know, there's some real simple things that we can do that are cost effective. They don't cost a lot of money, but they make us a lot more secure. One of those things is making sure, as a starting point, we have our doors locked. I can't tell you how many times I've been to programs. I was just in one in Kansas. I walked up to the place and the door was wide open. And, you know, friends, we're sadly past that point in this country. That's not acceptable anymore. Same token with people that have keypads, you know, to guard their entry. I can't tell you, Lisa, how many times I've come up and the keypad combination is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, or programs that have one code for everybody, and the code has never been changed. And maybe the code is the zip code of the town or the last 4 digits of the phone number. Or, you know, it's really, we got to start taking this stuff a little bit more seriously, because we are going to get burned at some point if we don't. So low cost, simple solutions like that. Also, you know, getting the parents involved, they can be our second and third set of eyes and ears out there. And that's important. But that also means we have to tell people we have to be a little bit less friendly in early childhood. And I'm not saying to be a jerk, but I'm saying if you see people that you don't recognize, stop and say, hey, my name is Andy. I don't recognize you. Can I help you? What are you doing here today? You know, something like that. Mm-hmm. Telling parents, if we give you a key fob or we give you your own individual access code to get into our building, please respect that that's for your safety and the safety of your kids as well as all the other kids. So don't allow other parents, other families to come and tailgate behind you. Don't be holding that door open for the people that you don't know, because maybe you don't know Mr. Smith just lost custody and he's not supposed to be here, that you are being a nice person holding that door open for Mr. Smith, and now you've just let, you know, some trouble into our space. So, you know, having those, and look, I hate to lose that as a society. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm a pretty friendly guy. But when it comes to the safety of our kids, you know, we just can't be too cautious on that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, back in our center days, this is like early, very early 2000s, we renovated a building and moved the child care program in there. And I argued and argued and argued and begged for electronic locks on the door with a card swipe system for staff and parents. And the organization I was running the program for at the time was reluctant to do it because, I mean, it was really a pretty new thing to think about for early learning programs. And they reluctantly coughed up the cash and we had the system. And a year or so after we opened, we had this tiny situation where we wake up in the morning to find out that the son of one of my employees had killed a handful of people with a hammer the night before.
Yeah.
And there was a good chance he was going to come looking for his mother. And they understood how valuable those locks were after that situation. And just having those doors locked made everybody, I don't know, 50% calmer. It was a tense, stressful mm-hmm. day. But just that got everybody through it a lot easier.
Being prepared.
Yeah.
So I think, Lisa, to answer your question, you know, I think it's the little things that we do that are largely invisible. I mean, no one's really going to notice if your door's locked or not. It's not as intrusive as, you know, putting steel doors up and, you know, metal detectors and all that. But it's those little things that we can do to be a little bit smarter and be a little bit safer. That can help fortify us. You know, everybody's talking about hardening targets, right? How do we make these a harder target? And criminals, by their nature, they're looking for easy targets. They're looking for targets of opportunity. So if they're, and we just had one in Maryland. I was at a program, gosh, maybe a month ago. There was a guy that got away from the police, and he started running throughout the neighborhood. And he was looking for a place to hide. And sure enough, the next thing you know, he jumps a fence, and he's in a playground. And he's trying to get into a child care program, looking for just a place to escape the police. Yeah. The same thing with the Parkland, Florida shooter. I mean, he put his gun down and he walked out with all the other students after killing, you know, all those students. And he ran loose in the community for about an hour and a half. He went to a Walmart. He went to a Subway. He went to a McDonald's.
Well, at least the sheriff, at least their sheriff's department was on top of it.
That's a whole different podcast.
Hey, Andrew, you mentioned targets of opportunity. I had this in my notes already. What do you think about gun-free zones? A lot of programs, schools especially, and I'm seeing in my early learning programs now too, these stickers on the doors, this is a gun-free zone. Isn't that kind of inviting somebody that wants to hurt people? I mean, isn't it like, hey, come and do it here? Or what are your thoughts?
You know, I wish I had the answer for this kind of stuff. I mean, I know there's, you know, a lot of different politicians, you know, trying to do different proposals.
Yeah.
The sad thing is, while all these proposals and legislation are being talked about, you know, more and more of these things start happening. So I think that, you know, we do have to take some action and get ourselves better prepared. And Jeff, to your point, I think we have to recognize that criminals, by very definition, they're not going to follow the law. So it might make you feel good that you have a sticker that says no guns, but I don't think that's going to be a deterrent for, I mean, look at the places that have been, you know, these things have happened at before. A lot of schools are no gun zones, and that hasn't stopped these from happening. So I think I'd be much more relaxed. I'd feel much better about, you know, doing stuff like locking doors, putting film on windows that is reflective mm-hmm. so you can see out that people can't see in, or getting blinds, or installing security cameras. And then I would about putting a gun-free sticker on the window. I don't think I'd have the same reaction, same level of calm if I just had a sticker on the window.
To that, sorry, I'm wondering, do you have any actual statistics regarding actual school shooter incidences in states where there is concealed carry permit? Like, I can't speak, I'm not hip to the actual verbiage that's proper, but I know there's some states where you can like walk around with a gun, and there's other states where you can't do that. Do we have any data that tells us that incidences are or are not more likely to happen in one of the states versus the other? And forgive me if this is an ignorant 101 level question.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I don't have that data. I'm sure it's out there. You know, so you're talking about states that essentially allow you to open carry with little restrictions. I don't have that data. I can tell you that, you know, most of the time when we think about active shooters, and there's a huge, if you look at the numbers, just historically the numbers all the way back to 1970, you start thinking about the age of the shooter. And I got to tell you, around age 14 and 15, it really starts to peak. You see the mass number of shooters that we've had, age 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and then it kind of starts to drop off. And there's been several studies done on this, but it seems that most of these folks are able to obtain guns that have been provided and purchased legally, and oftentimes are getting the guns from their parents. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just a nice reminder of, you know, if you are a gun owner, make sure that you have that somewhere that's locked up, or make sure you have it, you know, not accessible to kids. If you are going to have a, you know, my father was a police officer. I, of course, had a gun in the house growing up. He was a police officer.
Yeah.
So I think there's a responsibility there to, you know, teach your kids about gun safety and, you know, not necessarily be afraid of the gun, but, you know, what is a gun? How does it work? How do you handle it safely and all that, you know, at an appropriate age, of course. But no, and to your point, Lisa, I don't have that data. I'm sure somebody does that.
Yeah, no worries. I have one actual more specific question. It's another numbers question. Do you have numbers as to how many active shooter school situations actually are occurring on a regular basis? Like, how frequent is this actually happening?
It depends on which side of the political spectrum you were living on.
Well, yeah, I'm not, I don't like to, even though I live in Washington, D.C. and work for the Senate for a few years, I don't try to inject politics in any of this.
Oh, I'm not asking with a...
Well, I mean, I see stuff just online, and one side says one thing and one side says the other. And so I'd love to hear from Andrew, because, like, I think we got somebody that's kind of in the middle there, is what I'm hoping. So,
because, I mean, I know we hear about the ones, like, even just the one, I mean, I know we're recording later, but there was one just 2-3 days ago, you know, again in California, like, so we hear it on the news, or we see it and read about it in the newspaper, but how many incidences are happening that we're not seeing?
So here, I'll give you a couple of stats, and I'll cite a couple sources, so it's not just what Andy Rozak thinks, but what actual public.
It's your favorite number. Right? It's the number of the day.
So here's one from CNN. This was dated February 14th, 2019, so a year after the Parkland, Florida shooting that happened on 2018 on Valentine's Day. And the CNN headline says, in the year since Parkland, there's been a school shooting on average every 12 days. Here's another set of data from the trace.org, and they track gun-related incidents. Now, their data here says, in 2018, there were 97 shooting incidents at K-12 schools in the United States, more than any other year on record. Now, they're saying shooting incidents, so that could be something like, I was a parent in the parking lot and I had a concealed carry gun and the gun accidentally went off. That could be looped into that. That's not necessarily mass shootings that are killing people. So again, I guess, you know, Jeff, to your point, depending on where you're at, you can spin numbers and all this kind of stuff.
I looked at one of those articles and I mean, they were in one of my, I read, and I don't know if it's the one you're referring to there. They were like somebody, they had a couple of them where people had gone to the school and committed suicide in the parking lot. And that was counted as a gun use. And so that kind of stuff. And
data they're lumping into this for their statistics. Yeah.
So, I mean, there is some wiggle there. So but of course, anything you try to measure like that is kind of complicated and depends on how you look at it and define things. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big take home message is, you know, whatever numbers you want to look at, whatever numbers you want to believe, or however you want to, you know, judge it, I do think there is an increase in occurrence on these things. And I think the time has passed to just be kind of laissez-faire about it. The time is here to think about it, take simple steps to increase your security. Don't be leaving the door open. You know, don't be letting people tailgate. Making sure that people that are coming to your facility are identified as visitors, whether that's a sticker or a badge or however you do it. We are perfectly within our rights when somebody knocks on the door and says, hey, I'd like to come in for a tour. Perfectly within your rights to say no. Mm. I'm sorry, we don't do unscheduled tours. If you want to call and set something up, we'll let you come in, we'll let you have a tour. But just so you know, before you come in and take a tour, I'm going to take a copy of your driver's license. I'm going to note what kind of vehicle you're driving and your license plate. And if you have a problem with that, I'm sorry, but if your kids come here, I'd do the same thing because I'm responsible for protecting these kids. I'm not just going to let some stranger off the street come in and tour my building with no notice. You know what I mean? So These are the kind of things that I think we need to be thinking about.
Yeah, and I think one last thing in relation to that, you mentioned, you know, if your worry is a parent involved situation in an early learning setting, and my gut and experience says that if something's going to go down in your average early learning setting, that's probably the scenario. And so a piece of this also is probably, you know, keeping up on relationships with the parents in your program and knowing what's going on to those families and having those open lines of communication so that when there is a relationship problem between Timmy's parents and there's a chance somebody is going to come and cause some problems, that you're aware of it because you've got those open lines of communication with the family.
Relationships.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or am I off there, Andrew?
No, you're 100% right, and you know it's a goofy saying, but say something or see something, say something really is the mantra that we have to follow. I mean,
yeah,
93% of school shooters, their behavior caused concern ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
80% were suicidal before the shooting occurred. 78% leaked plans on social media or in their journals or on Facebook or whatever ahead of time. I mean, think about the Parkland, Florida shooting. This kid was known by law enforcement. He was visited 45 times by the police, 45 times. He actually was expelled from his child care program. This kid had a history of bad behavior. So, you know, when we see these kind of things, we need to really be taking this seriously. There was a study done last year looking at, it was around 35 school shooters in the recent history. And out of 35 of them, 32 had some kind of connection to Columbine. They had either studied it, they'd idolized it, they'd watch YouTube videos. In one case, one of the future shooters asked his parents for spring break, for spring vacation, not to go to a theme park, not to go on some kind of great vacation. He wanted the parents to take him to Columbine High School as their summer, their spring vacation.
That would almost seem like some sort of warning signal that they somebody could have picked up on.
Well, I would sure think.
I was going to ask you, I started it, but I wanted to let you finish your thought. I'm a notorious interrupter, and I apologize for that. Is Columbine collectively seen as I don't want to say the starting spot, because clearly incidences were probably happening, but is that kind of seen as the beginning of us paying more attention to incidences like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously you're 100% correct. There were shootings, you know, well before Columbine, but that was really the one that kind of captured the country's attention, in my opinion. And it's been, what's it been, over 20 years now since Columbine happened. And that school has become such a magnet for people with disturbed minds that they're actually thinking about tearing it down.
For reals.
Yeah, and I forget the figures. I think it was going to be like, I want to say it was like $840 million or something in that ballpark to rebuild it. It was something astronomical. But really in Columbine, you see a couple of really unique things. First off, you saw a documented 6 to 8 minute delay between the time the first gunshots are fired and the first 911 call was made.
Yeah.
And 6 to 8 minutes, that's a long time.
People,
and they said, well, you know, I don't know. I thought it was fireworks. I thought it was a senior prank. I thought it was a car backfiring. They just couldn't mentally go there and process what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
The other big thing that we see in Columbine is we saw a police response. The first police units got on the scene in about 17 minutes. And the officer called back and said, yep, I hear shooting inside. Get me the SWAT team. And they stayed outside, and it took SWAT 47 minutes to get on the scene before they finally entered the building.
Oh.
Well, obviously, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
But not in 1999 it did. But, you know, officers weren't trained. Officers didn't have the tactics. Officers didn't have the weaponry needed to go in and deal with these situations. Now the expectation is, if you're the first officer, you're going in. There was a shooting in Aurora, Colorado just a few months ago. The first five officers that went in, one arrived, he went in. The second arrived, he went in. The third arrived, she went in. First five officers in the door all went in. They all got shot. But that's the expectation. But, you know, just as we're sitting here and learning from this, the bad guys, unfortunately, are learning from this as well. So our challenge is to stay one step ahead of the next bad guy. And I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing police departments, you know, going more military on some of this stuff with, you know, bulletproof shields and flashbangs and smoke grenades and this kind of stuff, because we can't simply keep allowing our police to go in and keep getting shot like this. I mean,
No, that happens. You end up with police who don't want to go in, and that's a tough situation to be in.
So was our innocence lost at Columbine? Without sounding overly dramatic, we clearly weren't prepared for that. I think
the other big lesson at Columbine, I think in retrospect, rightfully so, the media got really scrutinized and continues to get scrutinized because of the way that they handled this. Mm-hmm. And the focus, as you recall, was really on the two shooters. They were on the trench coats and the music and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And it led to this culture, this culture of now these shooters are all of a sudden being idolized, right?
Yep.
And there's a big movement, if you've noticed today, and if you take our training, I never mention the names of the shooters. We're part of this no notoriety movement. We don't want the notoriety to go to these people. Yeah, I'd rather talk to you about the heroes and the victims and the people suffered from this, as opposed to creating more copycats. There was just that movie, the Joker movie, that was released. And I got to tell you, the intelligence wires were all a chatter. It's really amazing that nothing happened, because a lot of people were concerned that that Joker was going to inspire more people because of the shooting that happened at Aurora, Colorado during that Batman movie back several years ago.
It almost felt like some of those news stations were just waiting, drooling for something to happen too.
Exactly. I think the news media needs to be a little bit more cautious about this. I think they're starting to get on board with that, but when the last, 32 out of 35 school shooters idolized the Columbine folks, and that happened in 1999.
Yeah.
I mean, most of these school shooters nowadays, they weren't even born, exactly. It's funny, I was teaching class the other day, and we were talking about 9/11, and I said, how many of you guys were alive for 9/11? And this was an undergraduate class, and one kid raised her hand. I said, oh, okay, how old were you? I was 2 months old. I said,
oh, God. Wow.
I'm a little, I feel old. I'm the classicness. I feel old.
Yeah, we have those experiences all the time, Andrew. Hey, I got one last question before we wrap this one up. We are big advocates of trusting children with weapons play, whether it's with your fingers or lightsabers and that kind of stuff, because there's a lot of valuable learning in that play. There's social skills and there's large body skills and there's problem-solving skills, and it gives them a chance to play with big ideas like power and leadership and control and deal with the things they're seeing in media. And people worry sometimes about kids playing this way. Now, there's no correlation to playing that way and growing up and being the quote-unquote bad guy. But when I'm doing trainings on that topic of play, I always try to make the point that we also need to kind of be very thoughtful about how we're communicating with parents about these things and their responsibilities. Things like making sure that if they have firearms at home, that they're in gun safes and those kind of things. So what are your thoughts on that? And also, do you offer any of that kind of handgun safety, weapon safety kind of training in your repertoire of offerings?
That's a good question. And we've thought about doing that. And to be honest, I probably need to relook at that. I thought about doing that a few years back. And sadly, what I found was that, if you start going down that path, Jeff, it starts introducing, and I think unnecessarily, but it starts introducing politics into this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, and we've been fortunate to train all across the nation, from California to New Jersey to Florida to Puerto Rico. I'm all over the place. Really, my mission in life is to get people more prepared. I don't want to have our efforts underscored or sidelined or looked down upon because they think we're taking a political position or not.
Yeah.
So I am open to that. I think it's important. I personally believe in that. I think that's being a responsible gun owner is very important. I don't know. I think there's probably some room for that in the course. And I reached out a while ago to see if we could just get a donation of some of those gun locks and just even set them on the back table as people are taking the class. Hey, there's gun locks here. If you want one on the way out, just grab one, and we're not going to make a big to-do about it. But I don't know. I just think it's kind of sad when people they hear this topic and immediately it seems like some people want to just kind of sideline what we're doing and the important work that needs to be done and just start pushing political agendas. So I've been struggling with how to do that, guys, quite honestly.
I totally get that, because people get so heated up about their politics sometimes that it's hard to just have open conversations about those kind of things. But I really think if programs are going to support that kind of play, they should also be very clear with parents about if there are real weapons at home, they need to be responsible with them, because, I mean, kids at pretty early ages, they understand the difference between play and real, but also they're drawn to bright, shiny objects, and a handgun laying on the coffee table is a bright shiny
object,
curious object for a 4 or 5 year old. And so we as the adults need to be more responsible so that we can be better at supporting the play kids are engaged in.
Yeah. And I think there's, you know, and study after study has shown, like, we need to get kids off these iPads and off these cell phones and actually get them playing like you and I used to do and playing with each other outside as kids. And, you know, I mean, I can tell you all the great memories I have of making snow tunnels in Illinois or building forts or doing whatever.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the kind of play I think we need to encourage versus just, you know, plopping a kid in a sedentary position in front of an iPad for 3 hours, you know?
Absolutely. Anybody have any thoughts before we wrap this one up?
I have one quick question. It's a practical one for caregivers.
Okay, Josie.
What verbiage do you suggest using with children during these active shooter drills? Because, I mean, for a lot of these kids that are 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, they've never even considered the possibility that someone could come in and harm them. So, like, what word choice do you use with them when you are practicing these?
Thank you so much. I think that's really important. So I would never use the word active shooter. I don't want to break that precious childhood that we have. I don't think kids need to be going to bed at night worried about someone trying to kill them. So I think there's a whole host of things depending on where your age, the ages of the kids and how, you know, how far along they are developmentally. Things that I've seen that worked well, you know, a game of hide and seek, right? A cat and mouse game. We have some programs that say we're practicing today for an uninvited guest or an uninvited animal that has entered our campus.
Oh,
that doesn't sound that scary. And if you live in Colorado and you got a bear in your parking lot, that's reality. We've got some programs that if you're too young or you have some limited mobility issues, your best choice is not necessarily to run, because you're not going to be able to run. Your best choice is to do the hiding, the barricading, the, you know, all that kind of stuff. So if you have a designated area that you're going to go hide in, we call that the beehive. And when we practice, we're the bees and we buzz over quietly to our beehive. And that's the kind of, you know, kind of way we do it. So 100% in agreement with you. I'm never going to tell a kid that we're practicing because someone with a gun is going to try to kill them. I think that shatters the innocence of childhood, and I am 100% against that. So, you know, just take this into account. I mean, we should be doing this anyway with our fire and tornado and all other sorts of drills. And I would also say use those as a opportunity to help craft your active shooter and lockdown procedures. Right, and it's in many ways the same thing.
Josie, that was a good question. I knew we kept you around for some reason.
Thanks.
Hey, let's wrap this one up. This has been Andrew Rozak with us from the Institute for Childhood Preparedness, childhoodpreparedness.org on the internet. You can Google those words and you'll come up with the social media for Andrew. This has been a great conversation, Andrew. Thanks for being on the show, giving us a lot to think about, maybe some answers I certainly didn't have before we got started. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for sharing the show. We'll be back soon with another episode. Bye-bye.
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 This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.